SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Bally's Las Vegas, the event center, the event, the 2020 National Horse Players Championship, day two, and Pete Fornital, good morning.
Good morning.
First and foremost.
Good morning to you, Steve. Great to be back here in the ballroom for day two at the NHC Moving Day, as we call it. There have been a couple of developments since we were last on the air. A few price horses have turned things around, but not at the top of the leaderboard, where Albion Benton continues his good fortune from day one. As of the last leaderboard update, still maintains an advantage, 222 points and 40 cents. But there is all to play for here. There are only three, maybe four players, I would say, who can feel assured they will be competing on day three. Of course, the top 10% of the field, 69 entries, will move on to the semifinal round. Historically, that number's been about 175 or 180. Yesterday, I was thinking it might be closer to the lower end of that range, but with the prices we've seen so far, I'd be thinking 180 is probably going to be our cut line, and we only have three players above that right now. As mentioned, Albion Benton, the blue-collar, 90-hour-a-week grinder from New Hampshire, 39 years old. He put it all together yesterday, had those two quick-fire cap horses, and is in the lead. Then we have in second, as of the last leaderboard update, we'll get another one soon, but last we saw Ralph Magnetti, 191, Michael Odoricio, 186.10, and John Vale, second on day one, holding the fourth spot still with 178.60. But I have a feeling we're going to see plenty of movement when we get a new leaderboard.
The most exciting part of what has transpired from last night and those that either licked their wounds or just kind of regrouped and those that went for refreshing, the best part is that it is absolutely perfect conditions nationwide.
That's
we're
right.
Fast and firm everywhere. They're calling it good in New York as they dry out, but for the most part you're looking at perfect conditions. And it didn't take long, Pete, early with the races that some might have jumped into, trying to get a quick leg up, and it happened really everywhere in New York. How about the homebred of Samantha Siegel, Master of Hope, and Sam and Michelle Nevin with the firster with Eric Hansel, worth $33.80 in the second at Aqueduct.
Great name for contest players, Master of Hope, coming in here to day two. There is a whole lot of hoping going on, and so far some of that's been followed up with by catching some of these nice price horses.
Maya Engelhart at Laurel, and Engelhart with outfits in New York, Maryland, and now at Oaklawn, and he had Jason Brin that was a $26 tote. There wasn't a lot of murmuring, but I did hear a couple cheering for Jeremiah. And then for the second day in a row at Gulfstream, a $29.40, and this was a big story, because you had two horses in the first race at Gulfstream declared non-starters. They may be the first two non-starters at Gulfstream I've ever seen, and they were both legitimate and good for Gulfstream for doing it, because it's the right thing to do. However, those that had found Miss Mack moving from synthetic to dirt, they were victimized for a good $15, probably.
That's going to be dollars that could come in very handy as we get throughout this day and towards this cut line.
Went from 15 to 1 across the wire to then push back to 10 to 1.
Whoa.
So a little bit of bad luck, but they still cashed for $29.40.
On balance, it's still a win, but I have a feeling there will be at least one sob story about that as we get to the end of the day here.
Well, and then the first two of the mandatories, both coming at Gulfstream, the fourth and the fifth, and the fourth was a decent enough $16 for Solar, who was about about 4-1, 9-2. But then you did have a nice price, Golden Tappet, a second-time starter that was a first-time Brendan Walsh, a horse that Mike Welch and the Clocker Report absolutely tabbed and pushed. And that was one that I guarantee you, with that was a key horse for later, you're going to hear that it was thanks to the Clocker Report.
That's interesting. I did hear that John Nichols had gotten things off and running today well. I wonder if that was a horse that he had picked. I know Jonathan Kinchin had that one as well. So, yeah.
John sitting 11th. John Clocker John, 148.60.
And may have hit something since then. So we'll have to see when we get a new leaderboard exactly what's happening up on this leaderboard.
We had a winner at Tampa in the third worth 41.40 as well. That was Getting Into Mischief, a Barbizon runner. And at Tampa, I just got a nice note on Twitter about a horse that we had mentioned yesterday with Marty McGee. When Marty and I looked at those maiden special races, and I will tell you that the guys over here were talking that they're concentrating. Ed Peters, for instance, Ed Fantini, Ed is concentrating on maiden specials for his electives.
It makes sense. I mean, you see a lot of long shots in those races when the data, the data is a lot softer when you're dealing with maiden races, and that can lead to more inefficiencies in the marketplace. Some contest players can't stand them. Others absolutely love them. We talk about betting personalities. We talk about handicapping personalities. It all comes down to that, whether or not you welcome these maiden races and the challenge they present, or you grind your teeth a little bit.
Well, this was Wanderlust, a Union Rags that Dean and Patty Reeves are involved in with Nacho Correas, and it happens to be a half to I'm a Looker, the very nice stakes filly that was by Henny Hughes. And as it happens, Correas wins at 12%. With his firsters, but a 246 ROI coming into this, and that's with a basis of 24 over the last starters over the last 18 months. So that's a significant number, and he did it again at 10-1. Wanderlust, the firster in the fifth race, the 6.5 furlong maiden group for fillies, and we do have a slightly divergent. Let's see. I want to give everybody the next mandatory. You're looking at the Aqueduct 6th and then the Oaklawn 5th. And so it just so happens, I guess somehow, okay, yeah, we're in good shape. We're in good shape. We only missed the two mandatories live on the air.
Yeah, not bad at all. Plenty of action yet to come. I really think we're going to see a different, feels like just a different character of day, and that just makes sense. When you were looking at yesterday, it's Friday racing, it's shorter fields, it's weather, cancellations, etc. Today we've got a lot more in terms of field size and stakes race action, and I think a lot of these players are a lot happier to try to sink their teeth into a card like today than the comparatively slimmer pickings of yesterday, though folks still did manage to find some prices along the way.
Well, and that was probably the surprising element, was that the numbers, when everything, the dust settled, kind of realized it was a pretty typical day one, despite the off-the-turf, despite the cancellation in New York, despite the scuttling the rest of the card at Laurel. Golden Gate, once again, and I finally got a chance to look. I got a chance to look this morning at the Sunday cards, and Golden Gate managed to do it again. They've got another full set of races on Sunday. So Golden Gate is going to continue to play a big role. And don't forget, it's a Saturday. It's a feature day, and so plenty of stakes action coming up, particularly, of course, from Tampa, but the Suwannee River as well, the Jimmy Wingfield in New York. Will bring you all the stakes as well as all the mandatories.
It's a lot of exciting stuff. I'm looking forward to this cross-country pick five that NYRA are hosting that pulls in three of those stakes from Tampa, and also it's all five stakes races, starting with that Jimmy Wingfield and going all the way through to
King Oakland. Cotton.
The King Cotton, exactly.
On the back end.
So it should be a lot of fun racing to follow, and going to be some great performances, both the equine and human, here on day two at the NHC.
One of the stories that we have to certainly point out so far on day two, $112.40 in terms of day two standalone results, Robert Courtney, the very, very sweet bittersweet circumstance involving him playing for his late wife.
That is amazing. And the funny thing about that, he was already on the bubble with his first ticket. I'm pretty sure this is his second ticket. So now he's dealing with that very real and frustrating tournament phenomenon of split ticket-itis to some degree. But hey, it's still better to have two in contention than to be stuck on one. He'll certainly have some tough decisions to make about which horse to put where. But yeah, Robbie Courtney, a very kind man. Had the pleasure of interviewing him for the pregame show, the Monster Pod that we did, and I also did a little write-up for the Brisnet betting guide about him. Maybe I'll go ahead and send that around again on Twitter for folks who aren't familiar with the story. Another one here, though, like our current leader, very easy guy to root for.
Robert Courtney with his first entry, $127.20, and then with his second entry, $100.60. So he's in very nice shape.
That is not bad at all. I wonder if there's any temptation to play the same horse on those two and try to make them move up in tandem. But, of course, it just depends on your opinion. If you've got strong opinions, nothing wrong with doing that. More common, I think, folks will take a race that's open and try to take two chances instead of one. The benefit of having two entries here at the NHC.
You certainly want to get an update on some of the winners, some of the previous winners of this. Jim Bennis has made a nice move up to 23rd, sitting with 128.60. Michael Bacek has racked up 58 points today. That has got him going with his $10 from yesterday. So he's made some progress. We talked to Ray Arsenault earlier. Ray sitting at 48th. 117.60. We had that fun conversation yesterday with Stanley Bavlish. He has not really moved much. 53rd right now, 115.60. So some of the prior winners trying to come back here. Let's see where Chris Littlemore is. Littlemore sitting 95th with one entry, 102.80. 5080 sitting 441st with another. And how about Scott Coles, who got his second entry, of course, and that second entry with $100.80, that extra play-in option that he took to try to get a second entry paying off.
Very cool. Glad to see that, and feels good. Of these 11 former champions we have in the field, I'm feeling pretty confident we're going to have one, if not several, moving on to the semifinal round tomorrow. We always talk about the stories we love to follow. It's always fun to follow the bonus stories. Doesn't seem like those are going to materialize this year, though, again, early days, that could still change. But following the former champions does seem like an avenue that that might yield some fruit.
Earlier, we also watched back-to-back as Roger Satina, two-time runner-up. Roger has gone from 0 to 60, literally, 63-60. And Roger, very pleased. They're standing. He must have, maybe he's got something.
He's got some skin here.
He's got something
in Maryland.
He's
actually hit one since then, Steve, I believe.
So a little bit more?
Unofficially, I'm going to call his total 82, based on a quick chat I had with him right before
very nice.
We went on air. And I think he'd only played three plays, three winners. I mean, that's how you want to get things started off here on moving day.
Well, we're coming to you from the event center at Bally's. What was your evening activity?
Oh, it was very, very mellow but fun. We went over, group of us went over to Carbone and drank some nice wine and ate some great food and listened to cool music and held, there was a moment of controversy. Apparently, we were at Phil Hellmuth's table, but I think when they looked at the wine bill that Philly Joe and I had racked up, they decided to move Hellmuth to another table. So,
I love it. I love it. It's great. We stayed right here. We John Nichols took out a handful of us to thank John out publicly for a really nice meal. It's right here, this BLT right in the hotel.
How is good steak place?
Excellent. I'm not a steak guy, but I had a couple of sides as my want. As it were.
You're so healthy, Steve.
No, it's not a health issue. I had pasta and I had little potato skins. They had fabulous little potato skins, sort of like the ones we get at Prime Rib in Baltimore.
Nice.
So, yeah, I have no complaint. John had a Wagyu beef
ribeye. He was thrilled.
Oh, everybody was happy. We had Duke and Paul, and we had Battler. Battler, of course, was on hand. Who else? We had Kimberly and Lucky.
Fantastic.
Duke's wife and daughter. Every year we mention Lucky. It's the greatest name that a child has ever been given. Lucky Matisse. That's not a nickname. On the birth certificate, it says Lucky Matisse.
That's great. You got to love guys who have kids named Lucky and Win.
Too great. You got a runaway winner here at Laurel. I mean a runaway winner. That was the Laurel 6th. We'll get a quick read on where everything is. You're up to the 4th race at Fairgrounds. You're up to the 5th at Aqueduct. The 6th will be a mandatory. Looks like the 3rd at Oaklawn. Tampa is in the gate for their 6th race. This is a first level allowance, a mile and a 16th out of that infield shoot on the turf.
They're going to really be coming fast and furious today. I got very used to that pace of yesterday with comparatively so many fewer races. This is going to be chaos, and it feels like at least for the first half of the day, we're only going to get the leaderboard updates after the mandatory. So hopefully pretty soon here we can start reeling in some players who don't have any optional action going and get some more updates from on the ground and bring you all the coverage here. As we get ready for this break in race 6 at Tampa.
And it's a big field, too, and we'll see what happens. You have, an 8-5 favorite, if I saw it right, and give a quick glance here at this field. Yeah, 8-5, tilting at Windmills, Chad Brown. In fact, Chad Brown and Seth Klarman running nearly simultaneously, the 6th at Tampa, and they've got actually a price at Aqueduct in the 5th as well.
Don't see that all that often. It sounds interesting to follow.
We can turn this up. Let's listen in to Richard Grunder and this allowance. Big, bulky field, and we'll see how the room reacts to what's going on.
To the inside surprise again. Up on the outside is Bond Woman. 2.5 lengths.
Feels like there'll be a lot of bullets in this race.
As they settle for their journey up the backstretch. East Coast Swing.
A lot of eyes on the screens.
Four rows in the two-path. Stocking second. Tigo is there toward the rail third. Fifth Sprightest is up on the outside fourth. Tilting and Windmills, the favorite with clear racing room on the outside fifth. With herself is bottled up, nowhere to go toward the rail sixth. Surprise again, and Johnny Velasquez now sets her down for the drive as they're midway in the turn. East Coast Swing is still in the leader. Four rows is now up to challenge second. Then it's a break of Felix back. Kitten Sprightest is now racing along third. And up on the outside,
Cap horse. Oh. 18-1 over a 24-1.
Unbelievable. Dead tight. Who do you think got this photo?
I think it's the inside. The line to Tampa is a little difficult on that turf course. We'll watch again in slow motion. But I tell you, certainly the two was coming. Anybody, not only is the two coming with Johnny V, Kent Sweezy, owned by Mrs. Thayer, Stella Thayer, the owner of Tampa.
There you go, the househorse.
Househorse,
potentially
indeed.
Getting the job done.
Showing the two on the screen. The camera is following the gallop out of Johnny and Surprise again, a noble mission filly.
Now you could hear the excitement. That was louder, I think, than anything yesterday. I don't know how. Were you here for the second mandatory? That must have had real hollering.
Yeah.
It might have been louder than that, but you can hear that. It's just a different. It's exciting on day one, but day two business picks up, and that race at Tampa was good evidence of that. As we're going into the gate here at the Big A with this big 1-2 favorite coming out of the 5 spot. I don't imagine there'll be quite as many people with eyes trained on the screens for this, but you can see just looking around the room that there are a handful of them.
The $50 horse, I think nailed the 11 at the wire. The 11 was Wart Rose. Jordan Blair sending out Julien Leparue on a rare front runner. And Julien, very good, actually, on speed. And
that's right.
Wart Rose ran, did all the running here. And if this photo comes up, I think the way that slow motion looked, and they're bringing the camera back on, I think to the two, and it's the two. It's a cap horse.
Oh wow!
It's a cap horse.
That'll be $64 for a handful of folks. You can hear how many people were cheering.
Of course, you don't know how many were cheering early as they were hoping to get the 11 home.
Yes.
at a fat 18-1 as well.
Would be great. Someday we'll be able to have that info in real time. It'd be very fun to pull up. It must be doable at some point to look and see how many players had each horse in each race. Be an interesting little piece of intel to help us follow things along in real time here.
We do get it, of course, for final table. Then, you know, as soon as the gates open, they flash the results, and we get to see the decision making, what people came up, what people settled on in the final table.
Just waved hello to Christy Moore, who finished third on the NHC Tour this year, was part of that pregame show we did. Not sure how she's faring in the tournament, but had some good energy, looked to be having a good time. She's got two entries, one with 50, one with 46.20. So, you know, needs to get moving, but certainly not out of it. Not going to be impossible to put up the 130 or so she's going to need to advance to day three.
Watching here at Aqueduct in race five, and you've got a 1-2, you got a 1-2 favorite that is sitting third and is being ridden a Dane Kubisky shipper up from Mid-Atlantic, and is plugging away, trying to nail an 11-1 shot. There's Johnny I, and it looks like the 1-2 is going to work it out. Although here comes a late threat from Informative. John Bisogno and Uriah St. Louis up from Philadelphia. How about this? The 1-2 shot goes down, but finishes second, and a 7-2 for Uriah St. Louis.
Not a horse that I would imagine too many people are playing. It feels like if you're going to go into the teeth of a 1-2 shot, I mean, obviously, if you love the horse, you love the horse, and you play it, maybe, but going into the teeth of a 1-2 shot, I think folks are going to be looking for a little bit longer price than the 7-2 when that's likely to return. You could hear the room relatively silent compared to the previous race for that one, probably with good reason.
11 horse field coming up at Fairgrounds as well. These are 3-year-old maidens, and there's an 8-5 favorite, Mike Maker and Corey Lannery. Sunrise Kitten, an emotional day undoubtedly for Corey Lannery as they run the Chantel Lannery Memorial Race later this afternoon at Fairgrounds. It marks the return of Alms for Mike Stitter.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Got to be a ton of emotion, a great tribute there, and you know that his mind is on more than just racing today.
We're going to talk to, let's give a little bit of a lineup check, and I know Christina Oliveras Blacker is going to join us.
Fantastic.
Saw her earlier, and she can't be here tomorrow, so I said we got to get you on today. Maybe get a little Roger. Fairgrounds?
Oh, he's got skin here. All right. What? Yep.
What?
Come here. Talk. What number are we rooting for you, Roger? Just give us a number to root for. Roger is
he's looking for a 33-1 shot. Groom Lake, Bobby Barnett sending out this Noble Mission colt. We just had a Noble Mission win at Tampa for Mrs. Thayer.
I'm a Noble Mission fan. Apparently so is Roger. He's got the good energy. He didn't want to stray too far from his lucky screen here. We may get an early version of the Satina dance.
We should bring the girls over, no?
It'd be great to talk to them.
Bob said yes. Gabriel Sayas swept the opening double and one more.
You're being drafted. No.
What do you mean, no?
Ravencraft,
what do you mean, no?
Patently refusing. You talked to us last year.
They're in the games.
Unbelievable.
All right, well, come see us when you have a minute. Folks want to hear. They're tired of hearing from us. They want to hear from you.
Richie Yang swinging
in. Back in the fold.
Richie jumping in. We'll see what Richie can report from his group of
How's the Monmouth crew doing, Rich? How's the Monmouth crew doing?
Oh, Nolan's the only one who's scoring something. The other fellas are... They need some of those bombs I've been seeing coming in. I just got here about 20 minutes ago, but I've seen a couple of prices already.
There's been several, and the one that Roger tabbed, the 7, 58-1 by the time they open the gates and is stalking the pace out front, that looks...
That is some story here. Horse appears to be running for the moment anyway.
Well, and the horse that he's chasing is a Gary West horse, of course, with that pink jacket with the diamond belt. And the two of them are a little bit out of range of the rest of the field. And they 48-4 for the half mile. So we'll see that long, long fairground stretch on the turf. And here comes cleanup time. Tom Amos ranging up. Now, Rogers' horse is plummeting, and it's going to be the 3-1 shot of Tom Amos with Brian Hernandez Jr. They're going to run away from this field.
Now,
easy win. There you go.
Roger, that was an illustration. You see so much from horse players about halfway through the race, start backing up through the lane. And just, not even there by the end. Just the old walk away. You don't need to saw everything you needed to see there. But, hey, I mean, to be in for to run half a race at 58-1 is still, you know, that's going to happen a lot when you're betting horses at that end
let's
of the
listen,
price spectrum.
Let's catch this.
Modification to announce with regarding tomorrow's final table race.
They're adding a so optional in case races come off the turf at Santa Anita. They're adding
alternate or optional?
No, an alternate race. If race comes off the turf at Santa Anita, they will switch to the Golden Gate and race. So, which is no risk of coming off the turf.
That's a smart move because it creates like an alternate race in case something happens.
Deteriorated significantly.
Yeah.
And this is
smart
scheduled to be a grass race. So we are making the following modification.
Yeah, they're just...
If tomorrow's Santa Anita race 8 stays on the grass, it stays as our final table race. If it comes off the grass, we will replace it with an alternate final table race, which will be Golden Gate race 8 at 4:15. So we will know, hopefully, when early changes are announced at Santa Anita, whether that race is on or off the turf, and then we will know whether we will go with Santa Anita.
There you go. Eric Wing with the news and the announcement.
Very sensible.
Yeah, makes good preparation to get out in front of it.
Come off the turf. And forecasts have been.
And this is another good example of the NTRA learning from past experiences. We've seen a final table race that you lose half the horses, and you know it just means much less chance for movement, and not as interesting, not as fun. So this is a smart way of doing it. You know, I don't know if this contingency was included in the rules, but to me, even if it wasn't, it's just like. It's just a smart play.
Yeah, well, just think what happened on day one. We lost two racetracks and had two tracks off the turf. You know, that could happen, pop up at any part of the country at any time. So I'm going to protect yourself for Sunday. I agree with you.
You mentioned Sean Nolan. He's another example of that split ticket phenomenon, potentially, because I'm pretty sure he had one that was up there yesterday on the day as of our last update. Scored 67-40 on that, so now he's got an entry with 114-40 in 55th in a tie, and one in 65th for a tie for 112-80. But certainly a player who's had success in this event and two chances to advance to the semifinals. He's got two in the semis right now. Of course, he's going to probably have to add about 70, 65 to each of those to have a good chance, but certainly drawing live to bring two to the final to the semifinals.
And Rich, talk. One of the things that we've already discussed and has already floated up in range and as part of the the discussion points, the target, the goal. Explain to people, the two of you particularly, explain how fledgling players come to understand the target that they need and how you strategize to pick the horses that get you to that spot.
Well, I know from, you know, from my formative days of playing tournaments, I was taught that one, it depends on the scoring, obviously, because the scoring is going to be different from tournament to tournament. But you can take a look at, like, previous year's winners.
Yes.
There's even breakdowns if it's a multi-day tournament. And you can kind of formulate what your targets would be for each day just to remain in the hunt. I mean, obviously, you want to have the best score possible to win. But you just want to stay in the striking range. So day one, day two, day three, you've got these goals. And also, I think a factor, too, fellas, is it kind of helps you avoid, like, getting emotional if somebody hits a bomb and all of a sudden has a big score. If you keep going to your target, you're not going to be affected by somebody else who just jams a big one down your throat.
Yeah, you definitely have to worry about getting off the bridle. You hear somebody else cheering a cap horse. It's easy to head towards tilt in a tournament like this. For a lot of players, sort of knowing what the target is and having a bigger picture goal can help. Historically, since this format at the NHC, I think the cut line every year has been between 175 and 180. And as far as how to get there, it depends on your handicapping personality and it depends on your specific opinions on the day. You'll see people who try to build that by stringing together horses in that sort of contest sweet spot. You'll see other players who say, you know what, I'm just going to try to hit three cap horses and get there. And it just, which path you choose, it just depends, again, your personality and also your specific opinion on this set of races.
And that's one reason why sometimes we see champion players have a zero score for a particular day, because if they're playing big-priced animals, well, you can go 0 for 12 or 0 for 15 or whatever the limit is. But if they connect, like you just said, and catch two, three, four of them, holy moly, what a score they're going to have.
The great Maury Wolf, who actually finished second in the very first NHC, said that in the early days of tournaments, you could evaluate the quality of a field in a Mythical Money event by the number of people who ended on zero, because they were very likely playing the right way. In those early days of tournaments, the value outsized for the ability to pick horses at the longer end of the odds spectrum. Now that we have so many people playing tournaments and so many people doing that strategy, I think you can argue there's equity in sometimes picking horses that are lower. Once again, it just comes down to the kind of horses you find based on how your brain works and how you like to play the horses.
Quick note, let's take a look at this seventh race at Gulfstream, because it is 0 minutes to post. This is not a mandatory in the contests here, but it is for the charity effort. And this was that maiden race we talked about quite a bit yesterday with Mike, and on Thursday with Steve Askin. Quick rundown, 17-1 on Mandate, the Pletcher, the one of the Pletchers, down on the inside, Rajiv Marat, and 50-1 on the Delgado, the two, the Gelfenstein runner, second-time starter, Guaco. Unrighteous, the other Pletcher, and this is a second-timer, Luis Saez, 7-1 for this Violence colt. Here Comes Bullet, the four, is 60-1. Anthony Pecoraro on the stretch out. We'll Sing for Wine, the Bill Mott, a horse that had been with Jimmy Ryerson and Team Valor purchased, puts the blinkers on. We'll Sing for Wine, 5-1. Telephone Talker, the Chad Brown, Ken Ramsey homebred, is your favorite at 2-1. Seems vulnerable. Seems competitive, but 2-1 seems low. 24-1 on Bourbon Wisdom. Ian Wilkes for Bourbon Lane. Spa City, the Kieran McLaughlin Godolphin Street Sense out of Sarah Louise. Spa City, a 2-1 near favorite. 5-1, All Eyes West. That's who I used in the charity contest. The Gary West, Jason Service Street Sense out of Mind's Eye. Macho Uno Mare and Holy Muchacho is 30-1 for Kenny McPeak. McPeak's got starters, a bunch of starters all over the place today.
I went with Spa City in this spot. I was expecting the price to be closer to 4-1 than 2-1. Not like I spent a ton of time on this. Obviously, we have 7 million things going on. 2-1 short enough, but in a pick and pray contest, you're sort of locked in. So we'll have to see how it goes. I'd rather be where you are at 5-1, though.
Baychik, the champ, coming by and feels like he's. Seemed like he's in better spirits than he was yesterday. Yesterday he was very disappointed. He told me this morning he was very disappointed with himself and with the day overall. But that that's part of what you have to deal with.
As of the last leaderboard update, 68-20 for his single entry. And definitely, if he's built since then, could really be putting himself in position to make an advance on to the semifinals and keep that story alive of the idea of a champ repeating in this event, something we've never seen but would love to see.
Here we go with that seventh maiden special, 9 furlongs.
Bourbon Wisdom. Length and a half to the favorite telephone talker who's very wide. Now the inside will sing for wine is second last and the early trailer is mandated. 23-2 for a strong opening quarter. Meanwhile, Castellano's moving his hands already on telephone talker while third last has one of the public bids. Up front, Spa City has the lead right back out of his Here Comes Bullet. These two are length and a half better than All Eyes West, who's now third. At the inside and fourth is Some Righteous. Back to fifth goes Holy Muchacho. Splitting horses will sing for wine. He got inside of a 3-wide running Bourbon Wisdom. Then at the rail, it's Guaco. Castellano still moving his hands on telephone talker, trying to get a response from him. And the trailer is mandated. 47-2 for the opening half mile. They lead the backstretch to move on to the far turn. On the outside, and Spa City up to take a narrow lead. Back to second as Here Comes Bullet up the third, All Eyes West. Unrighteous splits horses and owls run for Sias. Length and a half back for Will Sing for one. Telephone talker trying to motivate himself from about 7 lengths off the lead with a quarter of a mile left to go. With the advantage, it's still Spa City. Spa City wheels for home on top by a length and a half. Unrighteous takes a mile second. Will Sing for one. All Eyes West and telephone talker are next. Less than a quarter of a mile to go. Up front, Spa City top of by Unrighteous. These two kick on. Spa City digging in. Unrighteous right alongside. It's Spa City turning away. Unrighteous and Spa City will deliver. Unrighteous is second. Telephone talker a lackluster third. And Mende is fourth.
Well, we're certainly going to only hear, and yeah, Mike Bacik, jump right in. We're only going to hear about these two, the Unrighteous that finishes second and chased Spa City down the stretch, and those will be the two 9-furlong exiters that people will start speculating about the potential for a stake try down the road. What was the time on this? Anybody?
I did not catch it. I'm not sure I could have read the screen from there.
A little too small.
Michael Bacik, you seem in a better mood than yesterday.
Well, that's not a big reach. I mean, after going, 1-for-18 or whatever, I've had a few caches today, so it can't be any worse. So, yeah.
Where does your entry sit at this point?
Oh, I think I'm probably hovering around 70-ish, something like that. So, I mean, I'm a long shot to make the final cut, but I'm.
How many plays have you used?
5. So okay. I mean, I still have 13 plays to go.
Plenty of power.
I
got to
find $120 maybe with 13 plays.
You think about 180 to make the cut?
I think so. What do you think?
It feels right. 175, 180. Depends. I mean, depends a little bit on what happens from here, but I think that's what it's been. I don't think it's ever really been higher than 180. So
right.
You're in with a shot.
In with a little shot. Right. We had a couple of table mates hit the, a couple of those big ones, and so we're all, three of us are within the top 60 right now. So,
do you change your strategy at all at this point in an attempt to make the cut? You reach for a little bit higher, maybe pass on some shorter prices. Tell us how it affects your strategy.
The way that I had $10 yesterday, finished with $10. American. And so I broke this thing down today into two separate contests, basically, like 12 races to start, and I needed $100. I needed to find 100 so I can get to like 110, 120, and then use the next 6 to try to, at that point, get to, because you're also in the meat of the card. There's better horses running later. You can find some prices that, with really good, reliable horses. So that's kind of how I broke it down today.
Horses, and
We'll see if that strategy works out.
Of the ones you've hit so far, were they ones you would have played if they were races that were yesterday?
Yeah.
You stayed very much with the game plan, kind of horses you normally play.
Yeah, I had the mandatory winner, the 11 horse at 16-1, which I bet on. I liked him. So, you know, I took probably a flyer at Oaklawn on a first-time starter that didn't win a little bit longer than I wanted to go. But, yeah, I'm reaching a little bit.
The mandatory winner, big push on Clocker Report, DRF Clocker Report, loved what they were seeing.
And I think that's the reason why I landed on that horse, because, you know, and especially in a race like that where Clocker Reports make a difference on those maidens, and so that gave me the push over the edge.
I want to welcome in Christina Oliveris Blacker, and I got to think it through.
It still takes a lot of people a while.
Right? It's three distinct
names. Old habits, die hard.
Yeah, well, how? Because you were out there as Oliveris for years.
For a very long time, yeah. And you know what? Truthfully, I actually got some pushback from some folks when I did change my name when I got married. And I had some people that were happy that I did and some people that were sort of surprised and shocked. And, you know, you grew up in this game and your dad was a big part of this game. But for me, it was kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I love what I do and I love this job. But first and foremost, I'm a wife, I'm a mom. And that was a defining sort of moment for me. That was my top priority and still is.
No doubt about it. Is it my imagination as we watch this Oaklawn finish? And you just had a late surge as a 12-1 shot at Oaklawn, Touching Rainbows, Phil D'Amato. And there's something we can talk about, Christina, the West Coast outfits that are being spread out into a new diaspora, as it were, essentially. And it feels like they're starting to, it's taken a start or two to adjust at Oaklawn in particular, whether it's the racetrack. What's been your view, and what does Dan, you know, what does your husband think? And what do you guys as a husband and wife in the game think about the situation, which is seemingly not, it may have stabilized, but it hasn't improved.
I think you are seeing that little bit of time for the horses to connect at Oaklawn, but I think you saw that very much at Churchill when the initial group of trainers left and took a big strain to Churchill. It took Pete Miller, it took Phil D'Amato a couple months to win a race, and these are very high percentage barns. And I think that there are a lot of people that have decided to leave California that are going to have a real wake-up call, because I think there's a very uninformed opinion that it's going to be easier somehow to go win a race at Churchill or easier somehow to go win a race at Oaklawn. But Brad Cox and Steve Asmussen and Bill Mott, and there's plenty of guys that have something to say about that. And so there is a learning curve, I think, for anybody leaving California right now.
What do you think the biggest factor is that might take a barn time to adjust in a new circuit?
I think there's a lot of things. I think just climate is one thing. The horses themselves need some time to feel good and feel themselves in a new place. The racetrack surface itself, every place is different no matter where you go, even if you stay within the same state. And then knowing where to enter your horses. I think trying to figure out, you know, if you're playing the claiming game or if you fit in an allowance, do you fit in a starter allowance? You know, you have to enter aggressively, but also if you're taking a string somewhere back east, you don't want to go in and lose everything the first month. Even if you get them all claimed, if you don't win, then what? Then you've lost half your horse population and you've shipped your crew out there. You're paying for them to leave. It's very expensive to split a stable. If you don't hold on to some of your stock and win races, you're going to get crushed financially from a business perspective.
Well, you've also got to move. When you move to a new venue, you've got to find a new farrier. You're going to find a new dentist. You're going to find new grooms. Not everybody comes with you. There's a lot of things, and horses are, trainers and horses are creatures of habit in a big way. And so those little nuances, I mean, getting a guy, you know, that you're confident in about you know, cutting heels right and toes, it's a big deal.
And oftentimes, obviously, the main trainer, his time is split. You're sending an assistant for the most part. You're not seeing the trainers themselves completely relocating and uprooting their lives. So your help is good, and obviously you trust your help, but if you're the boss isn't there with his eyes on the horses every single day. There's going to be some things that maybe he would have done differently if he was 100% and fully in that space.
Yeah, learning curve definitely seems to be the right term to describe it.
I think the biggest challenge that we are facing now in California because of that is, you know, the safety measures are working. The horse population is a lot healthier now. Everything that they're doing at the Stronach Group, I think, has made a huge change in a positive direction. But now so many horses have left in the process that the new problem is filling the races, getting the races to go. I mean, I'll just give you an example. Dan had a horse that ran a week or so ago, ran a very good second, routing on the turf. He's 4 years old, maiden special weight. But he wanted to try him on the dirt and waited and waited and waited, and they could not get the maiden special weight dirt route four and up to go. All of those horses are at Oaklawn. And so for, you know, the trainers that are staying committed to Southern California, I think it's really difficult and it's really frustrating, and they are under the assumption that many of these horses and trainers are going to come back at some way. They want to come back for Del Mar. Who knows what happens next winter? But in the meantime, as you have taken your horses elsewhere, which everybody has to run their own business, and I understand and respect that, in the meantime, it's ruining the product for everybody that's trying to stay there and make it work and trying to be committed to California.
There, you know, there's also on that specific, and that specific case, four and ups, made special. There's a house rule now that if you're an unraced four-year-old, you're immediately on the vet list without whether it's a horse that is. I mean, they're making an assumption that this is an unraced horse, so, and it's four, and so it must be it must have issues. That might be true. It might not be true. But in the meantime, they've made it into a complete hoop jump to even get a horse like this into a race. And, you know, we understand, you know, preventive measures and trying to anticipate issues and the kinds of situations that, you know, we've talked about so much about being out ahead of it. But this is a case where they've kept horses from running that even when they, because even now when they work for the vet to get off the vet list, they now have to wait for days for tests to come back. And they're still not letting them in. They have to work within a certain number of days of entering, and then in some cases, the tests haven't come back, so they still won't let them enter.
I think that as in any period of change, it's a learning curve there too, right? Ooh. And so all you can do is control the variables at hand and what the data is presenting, and I think that is what is being tried to accomplish from, you know, their perspective. And I do think you're going to see all of these things evolve, I think should be maybe the correct word, not necessarily change, but putting into place as much as they can as far as the reforms go, and then evolving those to the times and to what needs to be done to improve everything.
I mean, I think we're going to see, you know, we're going to see the pendulum swing too far, hopefully, because that's how we get evolution and change, which we need. So, yes, there'll be some situations like Steve just talked about where it doesn't really make sense, but that's just how it's going to work, because we have to take those steps in order to make it right at some point. And if we don't, it's going to look bad, and we've looked bad for too long now, and so we have to start. It's not going to be right. You can't wave a wand, you know, so those things are going to happen.
Well, and change takes time, too, and I think, you know, this is going to be a tough winter just because of the horse population being gone, but I'm hopeful that there are some new ideas next year to maybe try and recruit some other horsemen to California, or to try and keep some of those existing horses there so that it's a little better next year and a little better the year after that. And hopefully in, you know, 4 or 5 years' time, we're seeing a product like we used to have and a safer product overall. And we can look back and think that, yeah, it was a hard time, but out of it came a lot of good.
And consistency. You know, you shouldn't go from California to Kentucky and have a completely different system of rules. And that, because that'll drive horsemen away from California if they think that it's easier to run a horse that's 4 years old not starting in Kentucky, because they got to run them to make money. So the uniformity is the next kind of thing that we have to, I mean, that's the big thing. Where is there, there's no national commissioner, there's no racing commission, you know, guru. We have to have uniformity of these rules or else venues are going to be in peril. I mean, when they find rules that they want to run and they're going to move en masse like they did from California, you know, and then they might not come back. And
I think the coalition is going to help that. You know, I think, again, it's going to take time. But when you combine them, I think it's something like 84% of the gambling dollars are going through all of those organizations that have come together in the coalition. So they'll need time, too. But hopefully they can start to enforce some of those rules across all of their own products and make it as uniform as possible.
Speaking of products, they're getting loaded into the gate at New York. And this is the sixth, 25 claimers.
It's a mandatory race.
I lost track of that.
Yes.
Yep.
Thank you. Well,
I believe it is.
Yeah,
it is.
And just to give everybody a quick glance, there's really no big prices. It's a very. What are you doing here, Michael?
I went to the one. I mean, I just didn't. There were no big prices. I'm just trying to pick a winner and get some points.
I took the nine sitting outside right now, but I'm still kicking myself for not taking Brennan Walsh's horse earlier. The race that ruined me.
I took the eight in here. Thesis. Here. Let's listen in to John Embriel.
Mo Diddley in the clear on the outside in third. Then it's Blue Belt, who's down towards the rail in fourth. Followed by Thesis. Stonebreaker is being asked for more, not responding right now. H-Bone is the trailer, the half and 47-1 as the field enters the stretch. And still sends a cross. Here's Summer Burton now from the outside to challenge. Summer Burton takes a break. Summer Surprise is back running in second. Down the rail is Blue.